Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's grilling of the chairman of the Fed by freshman Senator Elizabeth Warren over the extent to which the big banks are too big to fail and whether they deserve an $83 billion subsidy that is about the same as the impending sequester cuts. Jennifer Taub, a professor at the Vermont School of Law and former Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments, joins us to discuss how the big banks are smashing the little banks, something that Ben Bernanke told Senator Warren he agreed with 100%. Then we will speak with economist Richard Wolff about the irony that the politician responsible for the European banks imposing austerity on Italy has made a comeback as the anti-austerity champion and now threatens to unravel the slow and painful gains Europe has made in stabilizing the euro. We'll also discuss a very similar situation here in the United States, where the gradual recovery of our economy, devastated since 2008 from the Wall Street crash, is likely to be reversed by House Republicans in the next few days. Then finally, we'll examine what is at stake in a federal appeals court case tomorrow in Manhattan, where the U.S. government has joined in the defense of Argentina to prevent vulture capitalists from undoing a settlement between Argentina and its creditors. Eric Lecomte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, joins us to explain how vulture capitalists like Paul Singer, who buy third world debt for pennies on the dollar, are able to get a federal judge to give them priority in getting 100% of the debt repaid in full ahead of other lenders and creditors who have agreed to settle for much less. Joining us now is Jennifer Taub, who is a professor at the Vermont Law School. Previously, she taught at the University of Massachusetts Amherst Eisenberg School of Management and worked for Fidelity Investments as an associate general counsel. Her new book from Yale Press, Perpetual Crisis, How Decades of Regulatory Failure Floated Banks and Sunk Homeowners, will be out in 2014. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you for having me here, Ian.
And I apologize, I've still got this horrible cough, but... So just bear with me, Jennifer. Now, the testimony today was pretty impressive. I must say, Elizabeth Warren is no shrinking violet, and she is exactly what the U.S. Senate needs instead of these sort of vacuous, pontificating, you know, establishment types. You know, she's actually trying to get some answers on the behalf of the people of the United States. And not that Ben Bernanke's a bad guy, but she really grilled him.
She did, and she really is living up to what her supporters thought she would deliver. She is standing up for the people, and she's continuing now in her role as a senator to demand answers and to point out what really is quite obvious, that the banks are still too big to fail. And that is, and the choices that we have made really to help the banks, the largest banks, survive and thrive has been at the expense of both taxpayers and homeowners and really the broader economy.
One of the issues, as well as the too big to fail exchanges between Chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, and Elizabeth Warren, the other exchange was about the $83 billion subsidies that the big banks get, which was came out of a study by Bloomberg. And I guess the subsidy is that given the implicit support that the federal government gives the banks, in other words, not allowing them to go under because they are too big to fail, is worth about $83 billion a year to these banks, whose profits, by the way, are about $83 billion. And more importantly, and this really I find galling, $83 billion is only $2 billion less than what is about to hang up this entire U.S. economy over, the sequester cuts.
You're right. Let me just talk a little bit about Bloomberg's research on that. And the irony of that number, too. And Bloomberg put out a report looking, trying to calculate what the subsidy is. And what they meant and what they mean by that is that the largest banks, whom creditors believe will never be allowed to fail, they're able to borrow for less and fund their balance sheets. And banks are highly leveraged and depend upon funding. They're allowed to borrow up to $97 for every $100 in assets that they own. And so when they borrow, the cheaper that, you know, the less they have to pay in terms of interest on what they take in, the more their profits are. And you mentioned how ironic it is that the $83 billion annual subsidy that these banks receive is quite close to what we're fighting over right now in terms of the sequester, and how devastating for the entire society an $85 billion cut would be. What's also ironic about that figure, and it ties into what the chairman of the Fed is talking about today, is that $85 billion is about how much each month the Fed, through its quantitative easing program, is buying up in terms of bonds. And so what's really sad right now is that the country is once again being held hostage to a manufactured crisis. This is the same thing as a fiscal cliff, just postponed some more. And what's terribly sad is that this is a manufactured crisis, where, and to some degree, the financial crisis of 2008, we can also see as a manufactured crisis, something that was manufactured over many decades through deregulation and regulatory failure. So I think, you know, the power really is in Washington to make this better and to stand up and do what's right to help this economy get back, get strong again, instead of this choice to make us suffer some more.
The big banks, in effect, only have to hold $3 in reserve for every $100 that they borrow.
It's not exactly reserve that they're permitted in terms of leverage. They're permitted to fund their balance sheets. They're permitted to borrow up to $97 to use that funding to purchase assets. You know, a good deal of these large banks, the funding is from deposits, but some of it also comes from very, very short-term, sometimes overnight loans, which make their balance sheets extremely, extremely fragile. And as you know, just speaking of the banks, the largest bank is J.P. Morgan Chase. It has over $2 trillion in assets right now.
Well, the while Bernanke was having this vigorous exchange with Senator Warren, by the way, they didn't disagree on a number of things. At the end, Bernanke agreed with Senator Warren that the big banks are getting a terrific break and little banks are getting smashed. And to which,
and he agrees that they're still too big to fail. He just hopes that the solutions through Dodd-Frank will one day be apparent to the marketplace, and they'll no longer enjoy that subsidy. But it's been a long time, and it hasn't changed.
So while this is happening at the Senate, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, is talking about how the benefits of being too big to fail, and in effect, he's saying that your pain is my gain. This bank is anti-fragile. We actually benefit from downturns.
Yes, I'm stunned in so many ways by Jamie Dimon's comment, the sheer hubris of it, how it's tone deaf, but also that he made a reference by calling J.P. Morgan Chase anti-fragile. That's a reference to Nassim Taleb's latest book. And in fact, Taleb was, if you follow this on Twitter, was quite surprised that his book title was being misused. He doesn't perceive J.P. Morgan Chase as anti-fragile.
Well, I did read the exchange. Yes, he's quite miffed about it. But Jamie Dimon, of course, is a very powerful figure, and exemplifies this sort of financial aristocracy we have, who seem to be immune from any political influence. If you saw the Frontline documentary questioning why nobody's gone to jail for the 2008 crash, they're immune. They're above the law, apparently. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? That I suppose it's not surprising they're arrogant.
Right. I mean, if you consider the fact that this is the same person who, just about a year ago, was calling what was later to be found out to be the London Whale fiasco, calling it a tempest in a teapot, and pretty soon it grew in a matter of months from a tempest in a teapot to a $6 billion trading loss.
For J.P. Morgan Chase.
Right. And, that this is the same thing, so I find it difficult to be certain of the veracity of the statements he makes about his bank. And you're right. If you know, when you look at the too big to fail, the too big to manage, the too big to regulate, and now the too big to jail problem, you know, looking at HSBC is a prime example. You know, here we are expecting folks to be held accountable where there was criminal wrongdoing with the 2008 financial crisis. But if you look at HSBC, when there's evidence of criminal violations, you know, for money laundering, and there's actually criminal culpability there, but nobody goes to jail, one sort of loses hope about the rule of law when it comes to these giant institutions. And when the justification there that we heard from the government was that one had to take into account the impact of charging an institution of that size with a felony, that was the justification, which is basically too big to jail writ large, but also that, you know, no answer for why individuals who were responsible weren't held criminally liable. And just to tie back to your comment earlier about Elizabeth Warren, Ian, when she was comparing large banks to small banks, you can just juxtapose HSBC to some small institutions around the same time where folks in charge were held criminally liable and sentenced for responsibility for money laundering. So there definitely is this double standard.
And of course, just to finish up on JPMorgan Chase, they were able, thanks to the largesse of the government, they were able to buy Bear Stearns at a fire sale price from the government, and they got a $25 billion TARP fund bailout. And of course, they're a part of the $83 billion subsidy that the big banks get per year, which we've already discussed. So. What's your sense then of where Dodd-Frank stands? The Republicans have fought it tooth and nail. They've managed to even get a court in Washington to throw out recess appointments. So the new head of the most important part of Dodd-Frank, which is the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren's, and that is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, or Bureau, I should say. He's now in limbo. So, what's your sense of how, you know, Elizabeth Warren's obviously fighting the good fight, but how is Dodd-Frank doing in the face of this relentless guerrilla war from the Republicans?
Well, you know, Dodd-Frank is a good first step, but it's a baby step. And looking back on it, I think it's clear that trying to do incremental regulation or trying to delegate to agencies, for example, things like the Volcker Rule, which was meant to be a substitute for the Glass-Steagall-type separation of high-risk banking from the public subsidy and plain vanilla banking, that idea that it would happen incrementally and that we could really trust regulators to make strong rules hasn't been the case. So I think that what was left on the cutting room floor that didn't make it into Dodd-Frank, things like the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, which would have broken up banks by size, for example, or other ideas about big structural reforms are necessary. And I do hold out some hope. I was just at a conference in Washington last month at the AFL-CIO, and one of the folks on my panel was Simon Johnson, who I know has been on the show. And, you know, he was talking about, again, the need to break up the banks, given the enormous political power they wield, as well as the danger they present to the financial system and the economy. And who he mentioned at that moment was an opinion piece by George Will. And so you have, I think the reason why there is a prospect of making a significant change is that the progressive left as well as the conservative right understand that this is not the market operating and that this is a distortion and the distortion must stop. And so, you know, there are plenty of names I could name drop here. I won't go through them, but as you know, there is a groundswell of support. And I think the public is beginning to understand that we need to go back and basically go back to the good ideas that didn't make it into the legislation and too big to fail by really literally saying that banks that are too big need to be made smaller. And this is not a radical suggestion. We're talking about reducing their size. If you look at the Senator Brown, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, has reintroduced this. We're talking about reducing them roughly back down to the size they were in the 90s, before the full repeal of Glass-Steagall and so on.
So, Jennifer Tower, professor of the Vermont Law School, previously taught at the University of Massachusetts Amherst Eisenberg School of Management and worked for Fidelity Investments as an associate general counsel. So at this moment, you know, where we're facing the self-inflicted wound of $85 billion coming out of the economy and the brinksmanship that's going on, which doesn't look like it's going to yield anything or prevent this unnecessary catastrophe from this manufactured crisis, it would seem that this is a ripe, teachable moment, and one would hope that the president could use it. I mean, if the president, I think, told the American people, by the way, this entire amount of $85 billion, that's what the federal government effectively subsidizes the biggest banks with every year, wouldn't that resonate?
It might, but I listened to this State of the Union address, the last major major address of the president's, and during that he did not properly contextualize where we are right now. In fact, the way he described things is that we had cleared away the rubble of the crisis, as if we were now the public and the economy had fully recovered from this crisis, which he didn't name. He didn't talk about the banks. He didn't talk about underwater homeowners and the fact that 4 million people have lost their homes to foreclosure and why we are struggling. You know, he didn't talk about the reason why this has been, why unemployment and underemployment is still so high. And part of, and without doing that, then people don't fully understand the need to continue to finish the reform that still is necessary. I would like to contrast that to a talk by the vice chair of the Fed, Janet Yellen, who just the very same day, of the State of the Union address, she talked about the headwinds against recovery, and one of them is the fact that in previous recoveries, housing has kind of led the recovery, and right now that's not happening. There are a number of reasons. In part, it's because people are, don't have the capacity to borrow. In part, it's because of this, of underwater homes and people who've lost tremendous equity in their homes. So that's happening, and so we talk about these headwinds for the recovery. And today, Bernanke is talking about how this, the $85 billion sequester, if that happens, will be another headwind. And so I agree with you. It would be wonderful if the president put this in historical context so that the pieces fit together for people. But I don't have much hope for that, given how he avoided that at the State of the Union.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you so much, Ian.
We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how painful economic gains in both Europe and the United States are about to be reversed.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound. Can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
It's the money.
Joining me now is Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and is currently a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. His books include Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, and Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And it's an extraordinary turn of events in Italy that the Italian people could have delivered such an indecisive election, and that not that Berlusconi won, but he effectively controls the Senate, which is the real power. Although without the House, they're pretty much gridlocked. What the word that you're hearing from the rest of Europe is talking about, you know, catastrophe and the sky is falling, etc. Berlin and Brussels' worst nightmare. How would you describe it?
Excuse me. Well, I think there's more than a grain of truth in the anxieties across Europe, particularly in Berlin and in Paris, because the vote in Italy is a stunning rejection of the austerity program that has been imposed. We should understand the austerity program had been imposed by the same Berlusconi when he was forced out of office because of upset about it. They snuck in an unelected Monti government. Monti was a banker in Italy. And what we have is now an election over the last weekend that rejected the Monti austerity program for Italy with the same, in fact, even greater intensity than Berlusconi had been rejected before. So the important thing is that the notion that the way you deal with the economic crisis in Europe is by austerity, that is, by raising taxes on people and cutting government spending, and that's what austerity means, and that, by the way, is what is going on here in the United States. What the Italian voters did was say, we don't want that, we don't accept that, not at all. And the way to see that is, the party that is the most lukewarm about austerity, although not clearly against it, now controls the lower house, that's the Democratic Party. Mr. Berlusconi came back, changed his mind, and became anti-austerity, which is no more believable than anything else he does. So that's another way to vote against austerity. And then the big surprise in Italy was the enormous support coming in third, but the largest single party by vote was a completely new party led by a professional comedian, Beppe Grillo, and that's the proof that the Italians are disgusted with all the old conventional parties. In other words, it's as if suddenly the Republicans and Democrats in the United States, instead of being the only parties, became barely junior parties to a brand new one led by a comedian who thumbs his nose at the political establishment. So it's an unmistakable vote against the kind of bank-oriented austerity championed by all the major governments in Europe and now rejected not by a little country anymore like Greece or Portugal, but by a major economy in Europe, third biggest in Europe, the Italians.
And, of course, what springs to mind when you make that analogy, Richard Wolff, would be John Stewart as the leader of the largest party since the five-star movement of Beppe Grillo's got more votes than any other party in the lower house in these elections in Italy. And he came in second, the second most votes in the Senate. Of course, to a lot of Americans, myself included, John Stewart would be an enormous improvement over most politicians.
Right. Well, we've been seeing for some years in the United States that each of the official politicians helps his or her cause in getting elected to higher office by positioning themselves, usually in an unrealistic way, but trying to position themselves as quote-unquote an outsider, a non-Washington Beltway politician, somebody who isn't tarred with the anger of the mass of people. Now that they've had an economic crisis for over 5 years, now that the political system proved itself unable to get the mass of people out of it, you're building up a head of steam. And it's not just in Greece, and it's not just in Italy or Spain. And by the way, Spain over the last weekend had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets against austerity. But it would be very naive to imagine that the situation that is so similar there to here and the austerity that is so similar there to here will not have repercussions and social explosions in the United States, just as it is doing over there.
And just to finish up on the almost incomprehensible ironies of the Italian elections, the idea that scandal-plagued Berlusconi, who is currently on trial for having sex with an underage prostitute, could make a comeback is mind-boggling, frankly.
Well, I think it's also, though, a sign of something. The Italians are not taking their own political leaders seriously. This is a collection of clowns. They don't trust any of them. They don't take them seriously as people with a program. They're just now voting sort of to thumb their nose. Vote for the guy who's on trial for sex with an underage prostitute. A guy who had a million women in Italy marching against him because of his anti-female political statements and behavior. And now a professional comedian who kind of throws together a set of ideas packed together from here or there. This isn't serious politics. It's the people of Italy are saying, okay, if you're not going to treat our problems as serious, we're not going to treat your political prancing around as anything we're supposed to take seriously. And a kind of to hell with you all is the kind of notion that we have to see here. And that's why it frightens the rest of Europe, because if this can happen in Italy and in Greece and in Spain, then the French and the Germans and the Irish are not that far behind.
And my understanding, the revulsion and rejection of corruption in Italian politics is overdue, given that to get into the Italian Senate, I think it takes more money than it does to get into the U.S. Senate or into the White House, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's an enormous, the corruption is a little bit different from here, but yes, in effect, there's a scandal almost every day. There's a sign of the people at the top, whether they be political leaders or the leaders of big corporations. They are simply playing with their money and their power, taking more and more of the wealth of the society, doing nothing to solve the economic problems plaguing the vast majority. This is not a sustainable arrangement in any of these European countries, just as what is going on in the United States is not a sustainable arrangement here either. And, you know, you're playing with fire here, real fire. And I think that we should be watching these elections, because the collapse of the traditional parties is the thing to watch. In Greece, just to finish this up, in Greece, for the last several decades, two major parties, roughly like our Republicans and Democrats, were in charge. For a few years, one of them would have the prime ministership, then a few years, the other one, and everything was going along. They shared the booty. They shared the comfortable roles at the top, the musical chairs between business leaders and political leaders. Then in 2012, after perhaps the worst economic crisis experience of any European country in Greece, the Greek people finally reacted. It took them several years of kind of shock at what was going on, but then they acted. And in the two elections of 2012, the two conventional parties, which had been getting 70% or so of the vote year after year, couldn't together get half that. They couldn't get 35% of the vote. And an extreme left-wing party called Syriza went from 3% of the vote to currently being, by polling, the largest, most popular party against austerity, critical of capitalism as a system. It is a sign that the old political system is crumbling on its failure to cope with the economic crisis.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, who's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. His books include Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, and Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. And of course, you could add another example, although a smaller example, since the entire population of Iceland is equal to one congressional district, they have completely rejected austerity and rebelled against the banks and the wreckage that the banks left, and forging their own path as well. And just though to change the subject or at least to tie in the analogies here between what's happening in Europe, a lot likely to happen in Europe, given that the slow and painful gains that they've made in stabilizing the Europe are likely to be reversed. But here in the United States, the gradual recovery from our economy that was devastated in 2008 is likely to be reversed by House Republicans in the next few days. I feel a bit like... sort of watching helplessly as a car accident is about to happen, or a dog is about to be run over on a freeway or something. It's just a hideous moment.
Yes, I think it's right. I think your image or your metaphor is the right one. I think the American people have been told for many decades that this is a basically healthy economy, that the trajectory is upward and onward, that the history of the United States, in which each generation lives better than the one before, is somehow built into our nature, and it will all resume. And as the people slowly, through this crisis and through the incapacity either of the private sector or of the government to get the majority of people out of the crisis, becomes clear that we are, as a people, a little bit like that proverbial deer in the headlights, shocked, unable quite to get our minds around that there is something going on that is not only bad for us, but looks even worse for our over-indebted college education doesn't get you a job, children, etc., etc. And I think it is going to produce a delay in a reaction. But then, as always happens, if a reaction is building and gets delayed, then when it finally blows, it can take startling forms. I think we should remember that when Occupy Wall Street began in October of 2011, it was only a matter of weeks before hundreds of cities had encampments in their parks, before polls across America showed a majority of people sympathizing with that movement. An amazing explosion of unprecedented historical speed. That's a sign of the building pressure below. And if I could say one thing about the parallels here in the United States, I think it's unfortunately the case that while the Republicans are pushing the hardest, the Democrats are not holding them back, or at least not very much. Let's quickly review. On January 1st of this year, tax increases on the mass of people went into effect. That's one half of an austerity program, taxing the mass of people. And let me stress it. The mass of people, 150 million roughly, who get a weekly paycheck, saw that the withholding for what we call payroll taxes, the contributions we're required to make for Social Security and so on, went up from 4.2% of our weekly check to 6.2%. That raised over $100 billion this year. That was a massive tax on the middle and lower income people of the United States. Compared to that, the tax increase on the rich, about which we heard so much news, was trivial. It took the tax rate for the richest, those earning over $450,000 a year, couples earning that much, which is a tiny percentage of the American people, their income tax rate went from 35% to 39.6%. That's a trivial increase. It's a trivial amount of money. It doesn't make any wealthy person significantly less wealthy. But the tax on the mass of people, that was a big one. And that is affecting our economy right now, because if you take all that money, tax money, out of the pockets of the mass of people. That gives them less money to spend. That means they can buy fewer goods and services, and that means fewer jobs of people producing the goods and services. And that was all justified, lest we go over the famous fiscal cliff. And here we are coming up until Friday of this week, March 1, and we're told this time we got another cliff, only it's called a sequester. And what are we being told? The Republicans and the Democrats are bickering over how much money to cut in the way of government spending. Well, let me give you a brief economics lesson. The government is the largest buyer of goods and services in this country, the federal government. If it cuts back the goods and services it buys, that's another blow to the economy, because with less goods and services bought by the government, there are less needs for people having jobs producing the goods and services that the government is no longer buying. So that will hurt the economy, too. That's why it's called austerity. Raising taxes hurts the economy. Cutting government spending hurts the economy. That's the real concrete result. And the reason we do this is in the name of helping the economy. That's like saying to a child, in order to make you a nicer person, I am going to beat you savagely. That's not going to work. And we have 1,000 years of human history that ought to have taught us to do better.
Well, perhaps the American people are going to get a lesson here in terms of pain with no gain in what government means. You know, the Republicans have been engaged in this free market fundamentalist jihad against government for so long. I think they've had some effect on the way people see government in this country, but they're going to learn that they're going to miss quite a bit of it, aren't they?
Yes, and I think this notion that the conservatives are against government, that too boggles the mind. Let's remember, when the private capitalist sector of the United States collapsed, starting late in 2007, across all of 2008, and into the first half of 2009. We had the collapse of the banks in the United States, the major ones. We had the collapse of General Motors as a corporation. We had the collapse of the largest insurance company in the world, the AIG Corporation. These were collapses not of the government, not of government activity or entity. These were private sector collapses, number one. When these banks, insurance companies, and large corporations collapsed, they all ran where? To the United States federal government. And they begged and pleaded for the federal government to bail them out, which the government did. Republicans and Democrats fell over one another to pour, ready, trillions of dollars through the Federal Reserve System on the one hand and through the United States Treasury on the other, into those corporations to help them when nothing else would have saved them. And we know that because they said so. They said, we're too big to fail. You must help us. And the Republicans and the Democrats did. Where were the Republicans then worried about big government? Where were the Republicans then telling us that the government is a problem, the government is a burden? Nowhere. They voted right along with the Democrats, first under President Bush, then under President Obama, to pour into the private sector the only rescue that could have achieved something less than collapse, and that was the government coming to the rescue of private enterprises.
Sure.
So when you hear now that the government is the problem, and it is so ingenuous that one cannot imagine a serious person taking that with anything other than a joke and a large grain of salt.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how a vulture capitalist got priority in a federal court.
And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done, for you and your children. Yeah, you are.
soul. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call Jill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say how slow. Dude, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric LeCompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric LeCompte.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
And tomorrow in the federal court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan, there's a very important face-off, a case, an ongoing case, where a hedge fund tycoon, Paul Singer, is suing the government of Argentina, seeking payment of $1.3 billion in, relating to bonds that Argentina defaulted on in 2001. Well, why don't you tell us why this is significant?
Sure. Well, you know, the Financial Times has dubbed this as the debt trial of the century. And, you know, they've done that for a very good reason. This particular case, although it deals with Argentina and a few hedge funds that are trying to collect, the ramifications of this case are absolutely global. You see, the types of hedge funds that are trying to collect this are what are known as vulture funds, and they even self-identify themselves as vulture funds. But what these funds do is they go into a country that's in financial distress or in the midst of a financial recovery like Argentina was, and they buy up their debt. They buy up their old loans for pennies on the dollar, and then when the country is in recovery, they attempt to collect on the debt in full. So when a vulture fund like these vulture funds with Argentina have bought the debt for pennies on the dollar, they then sue to collect the full dollar and often make a 400% profit. So what's happening right now with this particular case that's in front of the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals in New York City tomorrow morning, or tomorrow afternoon, I should say, is incredibly significant. Because this case that's taking place will have repercussions that are heard around the globe. If the vulture funds win that are suing Argentina, if they win this case, what it means is that for the poorest countries in the world and the most vulnerable economies around the world, vulture hedge funds like NML Capital, like Elliott, are going to be able to buy up their debt and sue these countries when they have any hope of a financial recovery. But if we win, if we're able to stop the vultures in this court proceeding tomorrow, what it means is it's going to push vulture funds back. It's going to make it more difficult for them to be a part of this unsavory behavior that investors, the White House, large international financial institutions are all very concerned about. So it's a very big moment, what happens tomorrow afternoon in the Second Circuit Federal Appeals Court. And it has the ability, depending on the outcome tomorrow, to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
But the way you describe it, Eric LeCompte, is that if they buy up the debt for pennies on the dollar and then wait for the country to recover and then try to collect the entire debt in full, even though they paid a small fraction for it, then they are really vultures in the sense that not a dead carcass, but a revived carcass. I mean, this is what's so extraordinary about it, is that they're punishing countries for healing themselves.
Well, that's exactly right. And in the case of Argentina, most of those who lent to Argentina, you know, made a debt workout or restructured their debt. But these few vulture funds have really been holdouts. And instead of trying to restructure the debt and even make, you know, what would be a relatively decent profit for what they bought the debt for, You know, they're unwilling to do that. They want to try and collect the debt in full. And because that kind of behavior is just so outrageous, you know, how these vulture funds operate, it's exactly why large international financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank really see a lot of concern with these types of funds and think these funds are overall hurting developing economies. It's why with this particular case tomorrow that the U.S. government actually got involved and filed in support of Argentina and against these particular hedge funds and vulture funds, because the behavior of these vulture funds, the behavior of these hedge funds, not only hurt some of the poorest people around the world, they also hurt most of the legitimate investors that are out there.
Now, how did they get standing to this point, particularly this Paul Singer, who's notorious for exploiting tortured countries like the Congo, etc.? This federal judge last year, Thomas Grierson, he apparently decided to go ahead and include these third-party banks in this injunction, and he prohibited them from proceeding with payments under the agreement that the Argentinians had offered up and all other debt holders except the vulture funds have agreed to. And he's holding up those deals unless all debt holders were paid. So he's going to the mat for Paul Singer on what judicial principle? I mean, this feels... I don't see the ideology or the judicial consistency here. It feels like the hedge fund billionaire bought a federal judge.
One can certainly see that. And I think, you know, that's certainly why what happened, you know, after the previous case went forward, that the Second Circuit of Appeals went ahead and stayed the previous finding and froze any payment from Argentina to these particular vulture funds. I think what's very clear and what we need to understand here is that how these vulture funds are operating is absolutely unconscionable. They will do absolutely anything they can to try and collect this unjust debt, even if it means trying to stop those lenders, those creditors who are trying to collect legitimate debts from Argentina. So that's certainly what they did. What these vulture funds did is they filed with the courts and they said these other lenders are receiving payments because they restructured. If they're going to receive payments, we should receive the payments that are owed us as well.
Even though they refused to join in the regime that was offered. I mean,
yes, that's exactly right. And that's why the Second Court of Appeals stayed that decision and said, you know, we're not going to allow Argentina to make these payments. We're going to freeze these payments until we can hear more hearings in the matter. And so that's why, you know, when we go into the proceeding that will take place tomorrow on February 27th, we think that proceeding is going to be very important. And very key, because the federal judges in this matter want to hear why Argentina should pay vulture funds and stay their payment to these legitimate creditors. So what's going to happen, at tomorrow afternoon's proceedings, is the judges will look at what's happening with Argentina. And I think it's very likely that they're going to see that, a continued payment to these vulture funds does not make sense. Of course, as Argentina wishes, it should go through with these payments it has to legitimate lenders, to legitimate creditors. But these vulture funds are simply not legitimate. And we have to understand the reason that, you know, these particular vulture funds and Paul Singer's groups are acting this way is because they have very few options left. They've been turned back over the last year in terms of these kinds of payments. It's been made very clear that these payments should not be made to the vulture funds. And in addition, we've seen these vulture funds lose legislation in the state of New York. We've seen them be pushed back at other opportunities. They've tried to seize payment. For example, these same vulture funds used a court in Ghana to temporarily seize an Argentinian ship this past October, and the ship was released and sent back to Argentina. But these vulture funds have very few options. And they're doing whatever they can to try and collect an unjust debt.
Well, I'm still puzzled, though, Eric Lecompte, is why a federal judge would put the interest of vulture capitalists and these predators ahead of legitimate debt holders who have agreed to financial restructuring of the $100 billion Argentinian debt.
Sure, and we don't know exactly what the reasons were, if the judge was hoping to move forward a settlement, whatever the reason was, but because the U.S. government was so concerned with what this federal judge did, they went ahead and they lobbied a friend of the, or they rather filed a friend of the court brief with Argentina for the proceeding that's going to take place tomorrow. And we know the second court, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, was so concerned with what the previous federal judge did that they actually made an immediate motion to essentially freeze the payments for Argentina. So Argentina is not making any payments to vulture funds. And what's going to happen tomorrow is the Second Court of Appeal is going to review whether or not payments should be made to these vulture funds. So I think whatever may have happened from a rogue judge in a particular moment, we already see has been challenged by the U.S. government and by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
So I guess what's really at stake here, Eric Lecompte, is Argentina's been in this 12-year fight to shake off its 2001 financial crisis, and this is an extraordinary anomaly that vulture capitalists are in there to essentially punish countries for recovering. It feels a lot like what's happening now at the federal government level, where the Republicans are about to punish the economy, which is barely recovering, and impose austerity, which will have a terrible impact, just as if the vulture capitalists win, in this case, would have. So it's a kind of topsy.
Right. There's no doubt in the case of Argentina itself, if it went ahead and, you know, if it was forced to make these payments and decided to make these payments instead of holding them back, it could push the country certainly into a financial crisis. If they refused to make the payments, it would force the country into a default, which would create major challenges for their economy. But the reality of it is that Argentina is only one country at stake here. Although Argentina is the country that's in play right now as these vulture funds are trying to collect, the precedent that this case can set is extremely important and can have impacts around the globe. So in other words, if these vulture funds win, it will mean that they have the ability, that they feel they have the standing and the protection to go after many more developing and poor countries around the world. And if they do that, they'll be able to buy the debt up and be able to force these other countries to pay. This is a major precedent. But if Argentina wins, if we win, if these vulture funds lose, it has also a very powerful and positive global impact, because it will mean that it's much more difficult for these vulture funds to buy up debt. It's much more difficult for these vulture funds to go after poor countries and the resources that these poor countries have at their disposal. So tomorrow's court case, February 27th in New York at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, will have dramatic impacts on international debt and debt restructuring all around the world.
So, Eric Lecompte, there's an investigative journalist, Greg Palast, who's been chasing after Paul Singer for some time and exposing his vulture capitalist activities in Africa and in Argentina. And I believe Singer sued him. I guess, in a way, what Palast has been trying to do is to shame this man. And is there a way to shame people who appear to be shameless?
I don't know if it's possible to do that or not, but I think what we're doing at Jubilee is trying to go by the facts. We're mobilizing the faith community. Jubilee USA was founded by all the large religious institutions in the United States, from the Catholic Church to the United Methodist Church to the United Church of Christ. And we represent more than 250 congregations and faith communities around the United States. I think what we're trying to do is stand with the poor and say that, you know, we need to build an economy that serves and protects and promotes the participation of the most vulnerable. And if these particular, you know, hedge funds that are ran by Paul Singer, you know, if they're going to hurt the poor, if these hedge funds are going to try and make it difficult for poor people around the world to succeed, then it's our responsibility to stand up and be able to publicly note and decry what these hedge funds are doing.
And I suppose, do you think, just in closing, Eric Lecompte, that we'll learn more about Judge Griessa reasoning in the next few days? He's apparently an 82-year-old judge that was appointed by Richard Nixon to the federal bench.
I certainly don't know. I think we'll all be watching to see what happens in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals tomorrow. And when that happens, And we see the reason that comes out from the court, we believe it's going to be one that is not in favor of hedge funds, but a ruling that's going to be in favor of poor people and legitimate investors, a ruling that says that that these kinds of hedge vulture funds really have no place in our economy.
Well, it's pretty amazing that he's won so far, Singer, thanks to this judge. Given what's happened to the economy and what Wall Street's done to the American people, it's just amazing to think that we have a judiciary that's so out of step with the American people. But that's another conversation.
Well, it is. And I think, you know, it's also very clear, seeing how the U.S. government has got involved and how large interfinancial institutions, even the International Monetary and the World Bank, have, you know, seeing these vulture funds as damaging for economic development, it's clear to me that we do have the majority of reason and popular opinion on our side.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Eric Lecompte.
Great. Thank you so much, Ian. Be well.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Eric Lecompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.